Welcome to a Tales from the South encore presentation. From July of 2012, here's Tin Roof Project number 22 with Clark Blades.
And if you don't hear say, yeah, yeah.
So how's everybody doing tonight? How about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is in conjunction with the 12th International Conference on the Short Story, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be found at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? An acclaimed author of more than 20 books, Clark Blades was born in Fargo, North Dakota, of Canadian parents, and spent his childhood in Alabama, Georgia, and Central Florida. A graduate of Denison University and the University of Iowa, Blades moved to Montreal at the age of 25 and acquired Canadian citizenship, where he remained for 13 years and founded the graduate writing program at Concordia College. He taught at Sir George Williams University, now Concordia, where he helped establish the creative writing program. Since returning to the United States in 1980, Blades has taught writing at a number of American universities, including New York's Skidmore College, the University of Iowa, where he was the director of the International Writing Program, and the University of California, Berkeley. A world traveler, Blades has also taught and lectured in Japan, India, Singapore, Australia, Finland, the Czech Republic, Holland, Germany, Haiti, and Mexico. Clark was also one of the founders of the Montreal Storytellers Fiction Performance Group. In 2009, he was made an officer of the Order of Canada for his contributions to Canadian letters as an author, essayist, teacher, and founder of the postgraduate program in creative writing at Concordia University. He has been married to internationally acclaimed Indian-American author Bharati Mukherjee for more than 40 years. Tonight, Clark takes us back to his southern roots in The Bridge. Ladies and gentlemen, Clark Blades.
I know that Florida is a bit of an ambiguity in the South. The northern part of Florida, where I was a small child, was very southern in the 1940s. The southern part, where I lived only for about a year, was quite northern. And I think Florida has trouble sometimes being integrated into the South, so to speak. The problems that Florida has continue to this day. It's a war against nature. Hurricanes, droughts, 20 inches of rain today in the panhandle. I mean, there's ongoing problems. This story has something to do with that. Picture another very hot day in 1950 in a little village called Fort Lauderdale, long before it became the international resort that it is today. Studio One reached Fort Lauderdale from the Dumont station in Miami, and in the summer I was allowed up late enough to watch it. We had no set at home, having recently come down from Montreal. I watched it at Rifkin Brothers Furniture and Appliance Center, where my father was the furniture buyer. The sets were round with magnifying lenses bracketed in front. The hostess of Studio One was Betty Furness, the Westinghouse lady. An enormous sense of power watching television behind locked doors while people press their faces in the windows. A seven-year-old responds to that. Beside me in the dark, mannequins in evening dresses stood by their washing machines, and upstairs my father worked on the books. Around 7 o'clock, his secretary would come down from the office and sit with me in front of the television and talk. She had a northern voice and a harsh one, but no demands were in it. I knew, in the way of a boss's son, that she liked me. I knew, in fact, she thought I was amazing. She took me out to get the coffee and sandwiches, a high point of the evening. A child hungers for that. There's something illicit in going out with a pretty secretary for coffee and sandwiches. Joan was her name. She'd been introduced to me as Joan, and a boss's son has that privilege, even when he is fast becoming a yes ma'am, no ma'am southern boy, and is otherwise overly polite. I called her Joan because I never learned her last name. Born at La Riviere up in New Hampshire, where they pronounced it Larivier, and she had been divorced from a Georgian named Holman after being widowed in the war by a man named Paulson. Widowed at 18 and divorced on the rebound and still only 25. She was tiny but ample, and depending on the day and what she wore, became a trifle plump or unbearably voluptuous. The word I know now was ripe. Her arms were full and downy, her waistline faultless, but a little too sudden. No room for a curving back and leisurely midriff, the gentle reach and suppression of breasts and hips, and I at 7 responded to that. She was old enough to be my sister, but just to be my sister, and that accounted for the whistle she got on the way to the carryout counter at the big Rexalls a block away. With the television on and my father in the back behind the door, I would prowl the darkened store, trying chairs and sofas, and far from the windows where people could watch me, I dug my well-scrubbed hands into the mannequins' dresses, over their cold, unnippled breasts, and up their fused and icy thighs. All of the mannequins, immobile, unprotesting Betty Furnesses. By the middle of the evening, I'd have all the girls unbuttoned, then by 10 o'clock, have them proper once again. Part two. We Thibodeaux went to the beach one weekday, a day of perfect calm. My parents lay on a blanket sleeping, and I ventured out. I couldn't swim. The Atlantic was glassy, even calmer than the Gulf, but without the slime of jellyfish. Just the weeds and spotted crabs. I walked out in the perfect neutral warmth, the pea-warm water, not flinching with the darts of minnows against my legs, not worried about sand sharks and manta rays, barracuda beyond the jetties. I'd read of the fishes, knew the dangers, but still I walked. No waves in sight. The convoy of giant tankers steamed across the horizon, and the illusion was firm that I could walk that day to Dakar or Lisbon. I bounced to shoulder depth, knowing that if I stumbled or if something large should strike my legs, if a wave or an undertow should suddenly arise, I would drown. At chin depth, I tried to turn, but couldn't without taking another half step forward to gain my balance. I opened my mouth to call, but only whimpered, and water entered. I thought I saw the dark, funneling shapes of my worst nightmares, and my throat closed with fear. I tried to walk backward and stumbled. My head went under, water invaded my ears, and then I was lifted, carried back a step or two, and set down in shoulder-depth water. My chest was still locked, and my father struck me hard as he turned. I coughed as I ran behind him, afraid to look back. "Dis rien, maman." "Don't say anything to mother," he said, and joined my mother, who had not wakened. He never spoke of it to me or to her. Part three. Fort Lauderdale had a city pool, a Spanish-style fortress across from the beach. Swimming lessons were free in fresh, icy water under a murderous summer sun. We lived 4 miles from the ocean on a brackish, unswimmable estuary called the Tarpon River. The river swarmed with eels, crabs, mullet, and catfish, and I had caught and studied them all and lost yards of line and dozens of hooks to the garbage fish that gasped and bubbled under our dock. But such is the access to the ocean. Before you can charter a boat, you haul up eels. Before skin diving, you learn to paddle. I never learned. The water stunned me with its iciness. It was a July day in the upper 90s. The noontime sun was a lamp that bleached the skies and burned through the droplets of water on my back. I tried to float and felt torn by the scalding sun on my back and numbing cold that gripped my legs and belly. I wanted to sink into the dancing blueness, the cold Canadianness of the water. No one watched, and bronzed Florida kids played dangerous games in the deep end. I left. I had biked out barefoot, towel around my shoulders, feeling very Floridian and almost at home. 4 miles from our house to the pool down Las Olas Boulevard. A scorching day, Las Olas was intersected by an old swing bridge over the inland waterway, which I, returning from the pool, towel on the handlebars drying, now approached. The bridge was out to let a string of yachts pass under. It wasn't returning in time to allow the backed up cars to start, and finally my bicycle began to wobble. I put my bare foot down to steady it, and suddenly I screamed. The black top was gummy from the sun, my foot already tar stained and burning. The bicycle toppled, spilling the towel on the crushed limestone shoulder. The wooden bridge was now back in place, and the guardrail was lifting, but I was crouched in the burning limestone. My bike and towel had rolled several feet behind me. The stones gave way to a sheer drop to the waterway about 50 feet below. My only hope was in dashing to the bridge, a splintery, weathered thing, itself hot, but equipped with a rail that I could lean over until my feet quit burning. And then my bike was further away than ever, and walking to it barefoot over the burning limestone or over the soggy blacktop seemed almost Fijian, something natives did in the National Geographic. My eyes watered in the blank sunlight. I looked at my arms and shoulders, and they were as white as a slice of baker's bread. Cars whizzed past, glittering in the sun, their windshields, hoods, and chrome work so bright I couldn't face them. Everywhere I looked, there was a haze of pink. It was like coming out of a Saturday matinee after 3 hours in the dark and letting the white buildings blind you. No one was out walking, not at noontime over the unshaded bridge, with just a bait and tackle shop at the far end. No one ever walked in the States, my mother had said. The door of the bait shop opened. Way in the distance, an old man started my way, drinking a bottle of orange and carrying a white carton of live bait shrimp. He was still talking to the owner as he walked away, and finally he laughed loudly and waved. I could taste the orangeade prickling my mouth as the man shambled towards me. An old man, dressed warmly on a blistering day, took a final swig, leaving an inch or so in the bottom, and flung the bottle over the railing and into the waterway. "Sir," I called, long before the man could hear. My voice was weak against the traffic and seemed to be whining like the voices of Yankee kids in restaurants. "Sir," the man drew near, holding the shrimp by the frail wire loop. The shrimp smelled and the water sloshed. I knew I could drink it. "Sir, would you get my bike for me, please?" The man walked past, smiling at his shrimp, squinting against oncoming cars. "Sir, please, please, my feet are burnt and I can't walk." But my voice was coming out a whimper and he didn't turn around. He just crunched on over the limestone in his thick, oily boots and was past my bike without looking down. Then he faded and I had to blink to keep him in sight. He climbed down the bank and settled by the water to fish. I lowered myself to the wooden planks. My shadow had made the wood bearable for my knees, then my legs, and finally I curled myself on the wood against the railings. There was a tiny knothole by my toes, and I bent over until my back seemed ready to split like a roasted pig's I'd once seen in the National Geographic. The limestone looked like white-hot coals. Through the knothole, the water seemed even closer, like Coke at the bottom of a bottle. If I'd had a straw, I could suck it through. And I remember the day I almost drowned when ocean water hadn't tasted all that bad. Now, blue, running, and deep, it seemed a cool blanket to wrap my shoulders in. And when the water became olive dark, strange shapes began to flutter. The channel seemed opaque, then shallow. I clung to the railing now. So large did the knothole seem, so close did the lapping of water against the piling sound. The channel bottom was heaving and rolling. Bubbles rose, currents dimpled. Needlefish glided on the surface. Mullet teamed around the piling. Snook leaped. A cabin cruiser that didn't need the bridge to turn gurgled under me, shattering the water for several minutes. The old people on board drinking beer from ice chests, maybe trawling and playing cards. I thought of taking down my swimsuit and peeing through the knothole on the next boat that passed. Maybe if I took off my pants and stood naked on the bridge, someone would stop and give me water, but I was afraid of getting in trouble. I lifted my head a minute and stared at the highway, now vague and white. I had the impression that I was going to die, and that dying on the bridge with hundreds of cars passing would be more pathetic than anything. People would know how I had felt. The old man fishing on the bank would be caught and thrown in jail. The bait man at the end of the bridge and the bridge man who must have been watching from the past 2 or 3 hours from his little perch at the far end, and the people on the boats who had passed underneath, and all the cars that had hissed past on a film of melted asphalt, all guilty of letting me die. If I'd wanted to talk now, I couldn't. My mouth was as dry as my back, and my tongue had grown to my palate. The water under the bridge was olive now, and my gaze penetrated far below the surface. The wooden railing jiggled slightly. I held on, afraid that I might tip headfirst through the pee hole. I couldn't keep my body against the wood. It was as though I were asleep in bed with my head sinking into the cool pillow and my feet rising slowly. In the water, which now seemed shallow, something enormous, flat and brown, tipped a wing and then settled back. The surface shuddered in response. I think, a voice that seemed to be coming from the wood of the bridge, and I had to force myself to remember that I was just a foot or two from the highway and in the middle of a sidewalk. I tried to look up to see who it was, for the voice was familiar, but as in a dream, I couldn't. I felt now as though my feet were waving high and I was somehow balancing on the sharpened pupil of my eye. When a hand came down on my back, I twitched, banging my nose. My God, the skin, look at his back. I told you that was his bike, didn't I? Go down to the bait shop and bring me some water. He's unconscious. My father. I couldn't waken to speak. His hands were under me now, trying to lift me in my bent position, but any movement was like palming hot sand over broken blisters. And the moment I was lifted from the knothole, the instant water was removed and everything again turned white and wooden, I began to shiver, then to retch. I wanted only to be dropped in cool water and allowed to sleep. I opened one eye, just enough for light to enter, and saw the waterway, and on the surface, as though I had conjured them at last, a school of manta rays skimming the surface and slapping their way out of sight. Then I slept, hearing voices and my father's response. I'm taking him home, yes. I'm his father, yes. I've been searching all over. When I wakened, it was shady, in a car, in the arms, I could tell, even with my eyes closed, of a young woman who had recently showered. The doors of the car were open. I could feel a warm breeze, though I shivered, and the ashtrays had not been cleaned. It's frightening, she said. How close. My back was cooler, but the pain was deep, more like cuts than a burn. I would have vomited, but felt too weak. I mean, if we hadn't have... You'd better take him now, she said. He feels a little cooler. The doors slammed, and my father said, I'll let you off first. I fluttered my eyes, but couldn't keep them open. All right, she said. And I could feel her looking down at me, stroking my hair. Such a little boy, really. And then, it would be bad if he saw me here, she said in that harsh Yankee voice. And before I slept, she added in the soft Canadian French of her childhood and mine, mal s'il me voit, bad if he sees me.
All right, so thank you so much, Clark Blaze, for being on Tales from the South. So this story is set in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. But when your family moved to Fort Lauderdale, you had already lived in East Point, Georgia, in Leesburg, Florida, and in a cabin in the woods without running water or indoor facilities in Lake County, Florida. Is that correct?
That's true. And Gadsden, Alabama, too.
What were those years like for you?
We had come down from the north in 1945. My father, being a French Canadian, had always dreamed of warmth. Of Florida, basically. We got to Atlanta, where he opened up a furniture showroom, which failed. He had to go then on the road and sell furniture. He had a route from Shreveport to Richmond. It was a huge southern route. And he settled us, for some reason, in Leesburg, Florida, which is a pleasant, strange little town. In Lake County, but Lake County in the 1940s was as bad a place as you could possibly be. It was run by a corrupt, rather vicious, and certainly racist sheriff named Willis McCall, who still feared 50 years after his death. But my father started a little factory, a furniture factory, in a conning tower of an emergency airfield that had been built in the swamps in central Florida, in Lake County. And strangely enough, it started to succeed, enough so that Willis McCall sent his boys over to beat up my father and take back the factory. So we were effectively forced out. And then my father went back on the road and had a huge automobile accident, which laid him up for a year. And that's when we had to move from the town of Leesburg, where we had three rooms in a house, to this cabin in the woods. It was $10 a month rent. And my only companions were moss pickers. And there were 14 of them living in one room. It was Faulknerian. It was really unchanged from the Civil War. I mean, it was, of course, the segregated South. It was impoverished. And the only redeeming quality that I think I got from it was nature. Because you were cheek by jowl with every violence that nature can throw at you, from worms in your feet, to parasites of all sorts, to hurricanes, and to illnesses that just hit all the time. And you realize that of the 14 kids that I knew from that family, I think 10 of them died during the 2 years that I knew them. Mm-hmm. It was that kind of poverty, and that kind of lack of any kind of help. I went to a migrant workers' school, which met twice a week. And the kids were, I was 7 and 8. The kids, and most of them were 18 and 19 kids. And I was still the only one who could read. it was the kind of thing, though, that got me, when I was at Denison and I started wanting to write, I said, well, what am I? What do I have that people would be interested in? What suspense can I gather? And I said, I had these five magical years in the Deep South that my Denison suburbanite Clevelanders never knew about. And they didn't associate me with it either. And so I started out turning stories out that were, I said at one time, so swampy they should have been drained. And sprayed after that. So the first 10 stories that I published were all of these southern stories from Lake County, which were really densely southern, Faulknerian, as I said. This story that I read today was written about 40 years ago in Montreal, when I was beginning to put together a larger franchise, if I may say, for myself. That is, that yes, I still held on to the South, but this was the urban South. Mm-hmm. This was a middle-class South. And this was a Canadianized South, the French and English Canadianized South. And those were all things that were, I realized that I had to integrate, because my Southernness was not bogus, but my Southernness was not sustainable over a long period. I didn't know the South after 1950. Mm-hmm. Things I understand have changed.
Just a little bit, yes. And so around the fifth grade, your father moved your family and you, now a Southern boy, to Winnipeg, Canada. Was that culture shock?
Well, I went from 95 degrees to about 50 degrees below zero overnight. My grandparents, we were living in my grandparents' house, and my cousins and all, and I had to quickly develop another, personality to deal with it. My cousins would get me to want to talk, and they'd say, "How now, brown cow?" And then I'd say, "Oh no, brown cow," to sort of mock them and their Scottishness. But it was a tough thing because American school kids who ended up in Canadian schools were automatically dropped two grades. But coming from my migrant school in Florida, I could have been dropped four grades. And my aunt, who was a very influential person in Winnipeg, said, "You will not do that." Canada being a little bit more authoritarian in its structures, she simply went to the school board and said, "That's not going to happen with my nephew." Mm-hmm. And so I had to, in Canadian schools, by the fifth grade, you were doing algebra, trigonometry, French, Latin. You're doing all these things that were far from the Florida curriculum.
You wrote that your Southern career was not long, but it cut deep. Yes. And so I know you wrote the Southern stories. How else? Can you elaborate on that for us?
Well, as I said, I wanted to have hold of something that I knew was authentic. I mean, that I could vouch for it really happened, and the only thing that had been given to me in that author's sense was the Deep South, mm-hmm. where those years in Leesburg and Tavares in the lake country, in the swamp country, and I exploited it, I guess, ruthlessly, until I had no more to say. And then that was scary. But then by that time, I had started to see that I wasn't just a Southerner. I was never really just a Southerner, but I was a Southerner with Yankee background. And it wasn't Yankee, it was Canadian. And it wasn't just Canadian, it was French and English Canadian. And so trying to bring, as I tried to do in this story, to try to bring all those things together was my new calling, you could say.
And so in the story that you read tonight, The Bridge, you had this near-death experience in the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And then you also left the municipal pool without learning to swim. So did you ever learn to swim?
Yes.
Okay.
Not proficiently, but enough to paddle around lakes and end up with a body full of leeches. That was in Canada. Yeah. And that's another story.
Well, good. We have a few minutes left tonight for audience questions. You can ask Clark anything that you'd like. And if you have a question for him, you can raise your hand and I will bring the mic around.
I'd like to know a little bit more about your time in Gadsden, Alabama.
It was like all of my times in those years. It was short because my father couldn't keep a job. My father was a violent man. He had been an underworld guy in Montreal. He had been a rum runner out of Montreal during Prohibition. And he was a tough guy. And he was illiterate. So you put all that together in the furniture business, which has a Yiddish word, it's called boraks, meaning that it's dog-eat-dog, salesman pitched against salesman for the commission. And so if you worked on something and some other salesman writes it up, he gets the commission, even if he didn't do anything. And that was open warfare for my father, because he only thing he had was his fists. And so in Gadsden, that was another, well, yeah, I hate to speak ill of the dead, but I love my father in many, many, many complicated ways, but he was a womanizer. He was a classic traveling salesman. And there was a woman in Gadsden, and my mother probably suspected that there was, but always went along with whatever he wanted. So we moved to Gadsden so he could be closer to her. But that didn't last very long because he got into a fight. Gadsden reminded me a lot of the South Georgia cities, and you know, like Valdosta and Americus and Tifton, those kinds of, if you know those towns, yeah, a big wide main street, and then drifting off into disreputable side streets. Various southern franchises, Western Auto, you know, all, I don't know if you remember, you know, all those kinds of stores. Thanks for bringing up Gadsden. It's never been in the forefront of my ever.
At what point do you think you began to turn the corner and began to think that you might possibly have a brain in there and could hold your own with the Canadian kids?
That's also a very good question. I think it had to do... Boy, I'm revealing too much. I was assigned a sixth grade girl to be my tutor. And I immediately, of course, fell for her. Her name was Valerie Kenny, and she was from the Kenny family. I don't know if you remember, but some of you may know Sister Kenny, the polio, the Australian nurse who did the blanket treatment for, well, she was the niece of Sister Kenny, an Australian-Canadian girl, and very, very bright, and took me under her wing. And she saw in me that I, you know, that I wasn't a stupid Yank, as my cousins reminded me often. And so, you know, there was a kind of, I don't know, Tom Sawyer, you know, Thatcher quality to it. You know, that it was not even puppy love. It was pre-puppy love. But that was one person I owe a lot to, and of course to my aunt and uncle who were, you know, always there for me, and telling me I was okay. And I had a very bright cousin, 2 or 3 years older than me, who was setting records everywhere, and she came around to my side, and you know there were things like that. They were useful. I had a very good teacher, and you know, the teaching was, teachers are everything, if I may say so. And she would stay after school for me, hours. If it took hours to you know, drum trigonometry into my head, or you know, she would do it. So that was Miss Corbett, Scottish, thick accent off the boat. It was just a very, the Canadian world was, you know, I was coming into it, it was my parents' world, but I was coming into it from very different, distant shore, you know, from Florida, and, you know, and it was so strikingly different to me. You know, we'd think of Canada and U.S. being very, very similar, but boy, it wasn't. Not for me in 1950 when I settled there. It was, you know, it was something that made me feel at home because these were confident, educated people, progressive mentalities, political animals, and I had been living among sharecroppers and moss pickers, you know, and I had seen the worst. You know, I'd seen the worst of the old South. So, you know, so it was, I felt I connected there more. I don't mean to insult, you know, the South, but, it, you know, there are histories. There is a history. Yeah. And Canada's not perfect either. So.
You stated that you had spent a bit of time in your childhood in the South. I'm just curious whether you subsequently, have you spent any extended period of time in the South? And if not, why not?
When I was at Denison, I quit. My parents divorced, and I was at loose ends, and I was a science major, and so I went back to Florida, got a job as a busboy, at a resort hotel in Fort Lauderdale. That lasted about 3 weeks. And a friend of mine said that he was on exchange at Fisk University in Nashville. And he said, would I come up to Nashville and do sit-ins with him in the bus stations and Woolworths and things like that? So I said, yeah. So I did. Ended up in jail, but with a good man. And I learned on two nights in jail, I learned more than I probably had in all my life. The jails, of course, were segregated. Now, that's one of the ironies. But we were close enough to where we could hear their talking and they could hear our talking. And I was in the cell with a man who had been a theology student at Vanderbilt and had been, of course, immediately expelled when he was arrested. And his parents' store had been burned the very night, burned down in Mississippi, where he was from, on the very night that his arrest was announced. But he sat there all night long reading aloud to everybody in the whole jail wing the letters of Vincent van Gogh to his brother, and the letters, Dear Theo, I don't know if you know the letters that van Gogh had written. And it was a transforming experience to me. I, as I said, I'd been a science student, I had a science major, geology major, and I immediately knew that I wanted to write letters like Vincent van Gogh, or I wanted to, I wanted to stay intact. But it was something very moving to me and a major change in my life. And I came back to Denison as an English major and started writing those swampy Southern stories.
So is this your first time to Little Rock?
I've been through Little Rock many times. It's the first time I've really stopped. I've been in Conway, mm-hmm. The first time. So Arkansas has not been a major zone. But I did live, one of our many short stops in Springfield, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And we used to come down every weekend to Lake of the Ozarks and things like that. So Arkansas is not unknown to me, but it's not been a central stopping.
All right, so thank you so much, Clark Blaze, for being on Tales from the South. More can be found out about Clark and his many books at clarkblaze.com. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Good night, everybody.
They say it's a lack of communication. I need some time to get away. Sail away and take a long vacation. And we'll dream of better. And I'm getting too old to fight it. I tell you the truth, sometimes I wear a thin sky. And I'm getting too old to hide it. At the mess we've undertaken, the silence is all we want to say. No more meaningful conversation. I feel our love is slipping away. These fears and these feelings are side, and I'm getting too old to fight it. I tell you the truth, that sometimes wear a thin disguise, and I'm getting too old to hide it. And I'm getting too old to fight. And all these fears and these feelings I've held inside, and I'm getting too old to fight.
Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, AY Magazine, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at InfraredStudioProductions.com. Our bluesman is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.